Hello and welcome to the Women's Soccer Coaching Podcast. This is where we take a deep dive into the challenges and opportunities faced by those that coach in the women's game. This podcast accompanies the April issue, which is available to subscribers right now. In it, we've got the usual session plans and practices, alongside advice on how to identify and stick to your coaching principles, information on a scheme helping to grow the number of female coaches, thoughts on why a female perspective is important for boys, tips for making your facilities more welcoming, and a lot more. Our main feature is an insightful interview with Becky Burley, one of the most successful head coaches in college soccer history, and she's also our podcast guest. For 25 years, Becky led the women's soccer program at the University of Florida, leading them to an NCAA Division I championship crown in 1998. She stepped down in 2020, but was lured back to coaching for a brief period the following year as interim head coach of the NWSL franchise Orlando Pride, where her players included Alex Morgan and Marta. Becky spoke to our feature writer Carrie Dunn, who started by asking about her playing career and how she came to moving from defence to goalkeeper.
The first day of preseason, our starting goalkeeper tore her ACL. The second day of preseason, our backup goalkeeper found out that she was academically ineligible. And so on day three, they were like, okay, who's tall, has decent hands, and is kind of dispensable on the field? And I'm like, I am. And so the funny thing about that story is I had actually spent the whole entire summer prior to my senior year working at goalkeeper camps, not as a goalkeeper. I was like the person like serving balls and shooting. And so I kind of knew the lingo and everything. I just wasn't, it wasn't really my thing, but honestly, probably should have been. That was my best position.
That's incredible. But yeah, the reason I asked is because you did go into coaching very soon after graduation. So that's why I wanted to kind of get a bit of context about your college career. Were you always thinking that coaching was something you wanted to pursue? I mean, I'm guessing yes, because you're talking about camps that you're doing before that.
Oh, I did. I knew when I got to college, and I actually saw like my college coach was a, you know, professional coach. Like that's what he did for a living. Prior to that, you know, all the coaches I had were like someone's mom or dad that was just volunteering some time. And I was like, this is what I want to do. And my parents were like, this is not a practical career. And so I said, okay, well, how about if I become a teacher and then I can coach and teach? And so my dad was a little more on board with that. And I was like, I think I'm going to be an English teacher. He's like, they never need English teachers. It's math or science. And I'm like, well, I hate math, so I guess I'll be science. And that's how it all unfolded.
Wow. So you got your first coaching job shortly after leaving college. You were very young to be a collegiate head coach. What was that like to suddenly be in that environment, but be leading the program rather than playing in it?
Well, I will tell you this. I'm not sure I recommend it for both either the players or me. I feel sorry for those early players of mine, but it was a little unusual because I graduated in May, took the head coaching job in June. I have a late birthday, so I didn't even turn. I was still 21. I turned 22 like midway through the season. And I had four players on that first team that were older than me. But I'll tell you, like, this is so fascinating to me because I didn't know it at the time, but looking back now, it's become so apparent. Like, because I really had no power, like positional power, I had to really learn to coach through more through influence. And that set the tone for my career that I never really understood until looking back at it. But when you think about it, you know, the higher levels you go, particularly when you get like to the professional level, you're not telling, you know, a Premier League player, hey, you're 5 minutes late. Let's run some sprints. Like, so you're having to do that type of influence. And I just got so many reps at it as a younger person that I didn't even realize I was getting.
Mm. Well, tell me a little bit about how your coaching developed during your time as a collegiate coach. I mean, your stats alone show how much success you had and how your players progressed, but you must have learned so much on that trajectory, just straight up.
Oh, here's another beautiful thing about being a really young head coach. Everybody looks at you and they're like, oh man, she's going to need some support. And so nobody is afraid to like help you, and you're not afraid to ask for help because you're like, yes, of course I need some support. And so I was really lucky both at Berry College where I started and then at the University of Florida, where so many of the coaches around me were so accomplished and so experienced, and they were more than willing to reach out and help me. And I leaned on that hard. And so I think it took my ego out of the way of having to ask or wanting to ask for that. And it took their concern about it right away too, because they were like, yeah, she's really young. She needs some support. And it was a marriage for me. Like, I felt like I just got to learn from all these people who had so much more experience than me.
And again, something when you're quite young, I wonder how you manage this and the pastoral care side of this, of the work for your college players. Now, I've been struck by you going on the record a lot throughout your career, and you talk about developing your players, not just as footballers, but as people, which can perhaps be sometimes it's overlooked in a world where you're chasing wins and losses. But again, as a young coach, how does that work? And what do you see as a college coach's main responsibilities in addition to what happens on the pitch?
Well, you know, my college coach was a huge influence on me, and he was very much like that. He, you know, he and his wife both were so supportive of us as people. You know, I don't even know how many dinners I had over at their house with their two young kids. And it just made me feel taken care of. It made my parents feel like I was being taken care of when I was 11 hours away. And so I think that carried over to me. And oddly, at the when I got to the University of Florida, I was the first coach there, and maybe still one of the only few coaches there that did not come up through like the Division I ranks as a player. And so when you come through like a Division III mentality, it is like person over player. Like, it really is, because you're a student first. And as you move up those ranks, that shifts a little bit, right? But it doesn't have to shift in terms of your holistic development of people as you go. Even to the point where, like, when I was the interim coach of the Orlando Pride, a professional team, you know, I stayed away from professional coaching for some time because I thought, very transactional environment, I'm not sure that's for me. But when I got there, I'm like, you know what? They want a holistic development too. It's just not a model that they're used to at that level.
You mentioned the Pride. I mean, that was, you know, must have been an amazing experience. But how did that come about? Because as you say, it's a bit out of left field, one might think.
Totally. Totally. The craziest thing about that was I had actually, you know, announced my retirement from college coaching. And I was on vacation, and like an extended vacation, which I hadn't really taken an extended vacation because you don't really have that much opportunity to do that. And, you know, the vice president of the organization calls me and says, you know, hey, we've lost our coach to Man U midway through the season. I'm thinking she's going to ask me to like brainstorm with her for some names. And I'm like, well, let me think of some people. And she goes, no, I'm asking you. And I was like, oh, that's what we're doing here. And so it was just a really interesting opportunity to grow. That team was freaking loaded with superstars. And, you know, I have to say, like, there was the part of talking to her and being like, yeah, this is going to be amazing. I'm so excited about this. And then there was the part of like, oh, shit, like, I have to actually go do this, you know? And so, like, getting in front of Alex Morgan, Marta, Allie Krieger, Ashlyn Harris, Sid LaRue, like, these are legends in our game. And that really pushed me to grow a little bit. I'm so glad I did it, because it got me a chance to see what that world is like and understand it to a different extent than just watching it.
You said like a transactional mindset. Can you tell me a little bit about what you mean by that?
Well, I just feel like, for example, like, obviously in the world of professional, you're going to trade players, you're going to gain players. And it just feels like for a lot of those environments, it's like, you know, the coaches don't want to really get too close to the players because you have the opportunity that you're going to be losing those players. And so for me, it was like, okay, we can all understand that teams are conditional, right? Depending on what we need for positions, what we need for specific roles, all of it. But that doesn't mean our relationship has to be conditional. So like when we trade a player, that doesn't mean I have to never talk to that person again or not, you know, wish them well and really literally support them as they make that transition and help them find the best next spot for them, as opposed to just being like, who's up next? And I feel like there's a lot of environments, especially the more you raise the stakes in terms of money, it becomes like a disposable environment for both coaches and players. And I'm not sure that's healthy for anybody's performance.
Tell me a little bit about what it was like going into that environment, because as you said, it was something that you hadn't done before. You're working with players, at absolute top elite level. How did you feel about that, and how did you kind of approach those first, let's say, first couple of games?
Well, the very beginning, I mean, it was like whirlwind. Like I was literally on the phone in Montana with the vice president. Like I was fly fishing that day, and then the next day I'm watching them play, and then the next day I'm at training, and I'm like, this is bizarre. And so the first few days, it really was just like a listening session. Like it was midway through the season, right? So you're at the halfway point, and you're trying to figure out like what have we dropped into here. And the players were great. Like they gave a lot of feedback. I felt like we asked a lot of good questions, and then it was like, how do you go in and change what needs to be changed, but not lose the base of what they've had throughout the first half of the season? And that was the tricky part, was like trying to figure out, okay, what is it that we're doing well and we need to keep down, doubling down on, and what is it that needs to change for this to become more elevated? And so just listening was the biggest part. And for sure there was like, I remember one funny experience. We were playing away somewhere and I'd gone back into the locker room after the game and Ashlyn Harris was sitting in her locker, like drinking a beer. And I'm like, you can drink beer in the locker room, And she's like, welcome to the pros. And I was like, this is so wild. And so there were definitely some learning curves. I love my favorite part was like, the game is over. We're back at the hotel. I remember one in particular. I'm sitting there with some of my friends in the lobby, and players are coming, and they're getting ready to go out. We were in New York or someplace, and I don't have to worry about them at all. Like they can just go do their thing, and that's just not my problem, And that was so different from my experience as a collegiate coach, where you feel like you're babysitting all the time. And so there was a freedom in that. And I have to say, if I had understood a little bit more about what the pro life was like, I probably would have tried that sooner.
Yeah, it's lovely the way that you're talking about it because, as you say, you had retired from Florida and you're taking on this fresh challenge and you talk about a learning curve. So, wherever we are in our coaching journeys, there are always fresh challenges. There's always stuff we can learn. That's fantastic.
No doubt, no doubt. I mean, I believe that to my core. I currently teach classes at the University of Florida, and I had never done that. I didn't even know how to use the platform to which we teach on. So there's like a learning curve to that. But that also, to me personally, is what is very stimulating about it, is because when you're having to kind of stretch yourself, like you can just feel your comfort zone. Like you're definitely out of it, but then you can feel it stretching as you gain these new skills.
Now, you've mentioned several of your own previous coaches and coaches that you've worked with. Looking back over your career, tell me a little bit about a couple of the most inspiring coaches that you've worked with.
One that probably a lot of people wouldn't think, because he's passed away, but it was Clive Charles who was coaching at Portland. And I thought Clive Charles was one of the best coaches on the planet. And I can remember one time we were both coaching at an event. I was really not coaching. I was like getting the coaches their coffee and stuff, But I remember the coach I was working with asked me to run this small part of the training session. And I don't remember the specifics, but I do remember we were working on throw-ins, and Clive Charles was walking by. And I'm like, oh, and so, I'm doing my session or whatever. And then later that evening, we end up, I don't know, at the bar or at dinner or somewhere. And he says, I love your attention to detail on the throw-ins. And I was just like, oh my God, he actually saw my session, And so what I really admired about Clive was, he put Portland on the map as a city in the US for soccer. So it wasn't just him taking the university and making it something. He literally made it a culture in his entire environment. And he was such a gentleman. He was such a giver. And to be fair, I had so many of those. Anson Dorrance, even as a, I played about an hour and a half away from him, but we're D3, you know, and he's the big king of everything. And he was so open to like sharing and letting me watch. And my own college coach, Joe Pereira, you know, I would never be where I am now without him because he was involved heavily in the Olympic development program when that was a really important part of the development path for players. And he, like I said, started out with me getting coffee for people, but then it led to like, hey, you got the warm up, or then you've got part of the team. And I mean, that was like an invaluable experience. Without that, I could never have been prepared to be a coach as young as I was.
One of my colleagues said I should ask you about having a Q-tip on your desk. Now, what was she talking about, and what can you tell us about
I
that?
still have it. It's actually right over there. For me, like, you know, I just feel like longevity in this profession is predicated on the fact that you don't take things personally. And actually, I gave advice one time to a younger member of our staff, and I said, look, if you cannot coach somebody who you think has MF'd you behind your back, then you won't be able to coach anyone on your entire team because they've all done it at some point, right? And so for me, Q-tip just stands for quit taking it personally. And it and the Q-tip box on my desk is just a reminder, no matter what, like feedback is usually more about people than it is about you. You have to own the part that is you, but you also have to let go of the part that is not you. And the Q-tip symbol just reminds me of that all the time.
And I love that you mentioned a coaching colleague there, because I did want to ask, having read various interviews with you over the course of your career, I'm fascinated to see the number of younger coaches that you've supported and championed. I'm guessing that's always been something that you felt strongly about doing, encouraging the next generation through.
Well, I'll be honest with you, I really got a wake-up call because I went to this development academy for the NCAA. It was called the Women's Coaches Academy. And I remember one of the women that was talking in front of the group, she kind of issued this challenge. She's like, well, what have you done to give back? And at that point in my career, I mean, I was pretty far into my career at that point. And I'm thinking to myself, and I'm like, I don't know if I can answer that very well. Like, I'm not sure very much. And as soon as I had that experience, it really came to light that I needed to do more. And I particularly felt like I was the benefactor of so many people supporting me as a young coach. Why wasn't I doing that for other people? And I think I just needed that wake-up call to remind me.
And I also saw a striking quote from you about a colleague who passed away, and you said that his epitaph wasn't his statistics, but the ways he influenced and treated people. How would you hope that your former players and your colleagues think of you?
Well, I hope they continue to think of me as like a thinking partner for them. Because I think, you know, this is something we talk a lot about. My consulting business with my business partner, Brett Ledbetter, is called What Drives Winning. And one of the things we talk about a lot is like thinking partners. And we talk about if you are, as a coach, always giving people advice, at some point they're going to outgrow you, at some point. But if you are there to be their thinking partner and you're asking them great questions to help them coach themselves, you'll always be a really valuable voice in their life. And that's, I think, would be the most important thing for me is that I could always be someone that they could count on to have a valuable voice, not in terms of advice, but in terms of helping them find the solutions that they need for the situations they're in.
I'm really struck about the way that you talk about coaching, almost like a dialogue. And I think sometimes that can be something that people find quite easy to overlook. They think of coaching as, you know, one direction, and it's not. It's a conversation. It's as much about listening as it is about talking.
100%. I mean, that's sort of where we're at with what we're doing with What Drives Winning right now. We do believe that, you know, coaches have been socialized, and this is not anyone's fault. Like literally, this is how we've been socialized to be like world-class tellers. We are great at telling people things. And we are kind of bad at asking. You know, we are kind of bad at listening. And the good news about that is it's just like any other skill. You can get better at it. It just takes practice. But I remember when I first started to get on this channel, and I asked one of our managers of our team to just track me for a practice and kind of count like the statements versus questions that I asked. It was ugly. It was not good. And I was actually conscious of it because I had asked them to do it. So imagine how bad it would normally be. And so that gave me a good base point to start from. And it reminded me of like the opportunities I had for questions instead of telling. And I'm not talking about like I'm not going to be in a match and saying, yelling across the field, "Hey, what do you think you could have been done better here?" That's not the setting for that. But I think when it comes to like leadership development and a lot of training, there is a setting for, "Hey guys, on a scale of 1 to 10, what did that rondo look like? 6. Okay, what is it that we would need to do to move that number closer to 10?" They have the answers. If I tell them, it's just like going in one ear and out the other. If I engage them with questions, they internalize that and it becomes their answer, and we can work on it together.
How early on in terms of age groups would you say that you could introduce that? Would it just be senior players, or would you be able to introduce it younger as well?
Oh my gosh, I think the younger the better, because one of the biggest things you, if you ask athletes, biggest struggle, it almost always comes down to confidence, like self-confidence. Well, how do you gain confidence? To me, you gain confidence by actually, kind of again, like we talked about before, stretching your comfort zone, actually doing things that make you realize you are a capable human and you can do those things. If I'm never sourcing my own answers and I'm relying on somebody else's, that's a slower curve, right? But if I come up with my own answers, I try those out. Some of them are going to work, some of them aren't, but I'm going to find my own way and I'm going to gain confidence from that. It's like self-efficacy. It's just learning to trust yourself.
Problem solving on the pitch is, such an important skill, but you can't always be looking over to your coach. Let's say you get sent to the stands for some reason. Being able to solve it yourself is so important.
100%. And we did this feature with What Drives Winning with a gymnast, and it was called Land and Look. And it was crazy because she would land her routine and she would look straight at her coach to see was it good or not. Like she didn't even trust herself to know if it was good or not. And what I would hope is that I would never want players to feel like they were in a land and look situation with me. Like I want them to feel their way through a problem-solving issue, like you mentioned, instead of having it to be me to solve it for them. Yes, I can guide them and I can help them, but particularly in our sport and in the middle of a match, like it's an inefficient process to try to be teaching something new in a match. Like why would you do that? If it's not something you've already done multiple times, the chances of that being successful are slim.
We've already said that coaching is a constant learning curve, and you've talked about, teaching at university, and you've talked about what drives winning. What's next on the Becky agenda? Do you still have stuff that you're chasing down next?
I'm really enjoying doing some one-on-one sessions with people where, again, it's like it's really just letting them find their own journey. It's not, and to be honest with you, it's awesome when you're doing it with somebody not in your sport because it takes away the distraction of me being able to even talk about their sport. Like I don't know anything about golf or tennis or swimming, so all I can do is talk to them about them, and they have to solve their own problems in the sport. I can do that same thing in soccer, but it's tempting, man. It's so tempting to go into the soccer realm. So it's kind of nice when you have the opportunity to stay in your own lane.
Finally, if you could give a piece of advice to 21-year-old Becky taking that job at Berea College, what would it be, and would she have listened?
I think she would listen because she was listening to everybody at that point. She needed all the help she could get. I think I would just say, keep asking questions, keep putting yourself out there. Because even as I've transitioned out of coaching and into like consulting, the ability to ask questions and the ability to not feel like you have to have all the answers. I mean, there's no possible way to have the answers in the consulting space because again, I'm not even dealing with my own sport. And so trying to get better at keeping my own experiences out of it, unless someone specifically asks, and really like using their context for them to help to find their answers. That's what I would tell myself. Like, keep asking questions. You'll get better at it the more you do it. It's going to feel uncomfortable. You're going to get rejected. You're going to have all these no's come your way, but then you're going to have some yeses, and those are going to be amazing.
That was the voice of Becky Burley, former head coach of the University of Florida and Orlando Pride, and now heading up a consultancy firm called What Drives Winning. Thank you to Becky for her time and expertise, and thanks to Carrie for the interview. Finally, thanks to you for listening to the Women's Soccer Coaching Podcast. Remember, Becky leads the April 2024 issue of Women's Soccer Coaching. Visit womenssoccercoaching.com to find that and much more.